Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Borja Sein. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's Viewpoints, extreme weather and flooding are hitting cities and communities all across Canada. New Brunswick citizens are calling for Ottawa to follow through on its pledge to introduce the Just Transition Act.
You know, New Brunswick is a great opportunity to create green jobs. Why can't we make solar? Why do the wind turbines have to come into by boat? Why can't we build them here? Why can't we be a champion in wind power?
While some people choose to live on their boats, others do so because they just can't seem to find a place to stay. In BC, the Gorge Island Marine Resort is working to fill that gap.
Most people are greatly appreciative to have a place just to tie up their boat and have a place to live.
The Shawville Lions Country Jamboree returns this summer after a two-year absence. City officials are relieved.
Coming back, and I've already got some responses saying, oh my God, we can't wait.
In Ottawa, hate-motivated crimes have increased by nearly 44% in 2021, according to the Ottawa Police Service, a troubling trend. And a century-old theater slowly comes back to life as COVID-19 restrictions are lifted.
Our revenues over last fiscal year and part of the year before way down because we haven't had to either had rentals for concerts or shows.
Welcome to Viewpoints.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
So extreme weather and flooding are among the risks associated with climate change for people living in Sackville, New Brunswick, contributing to calls for a rapid transition away from fossil fuels. In 2019, the Federal Liberal Party promised the government would introduce a Just Transition Act. That's to give workers access to the training, support, and new opportunities needed to succeed in the clean economy. The energy sector is a big part of the Canadian economy, raising questions about the future for workers who depend on those jobs and their communities. This March, rallies took place in communities across Canada, including in Moncton, New Brunswick, just outside the office of Jeanette Petitpas-Taylor, Minister of Official Languages and Minister responsible for the Atlantic Canada Opportunities Agency. Manifestations calling for Ottawa to follow through on that pledge on the Just Transition Act. Daniel Légère, the president of the New Brunswick Federation of Labour, is calling for a just transition from the fossil fuel economy. He spoke to our journalist David Gordon Kosh about what a just transition means for workers in that province.
Well, to me, it means retraining workers that are presently working and making, you know, those are for the most part a unionized job, well-paying jobs, which support their families and their communities and the province as well with the taxes they pay. So, you know, there has to be a significant investment. And as we transition to a green economy, as workers leave the fossil or as we downsize our dependency on fossil fuels and move to a green economy, you know, our position is there has to be huge public investment in a green economy at all levels of government, federal, provincial, as well as municipal. And that, you know, it's certainly at the top of the list is if we want to stop the effects of fossil fuels and global warming, is we got to invest number one in public transit. And there's, you know, falling out of that, governments have to make it affordable and more attractive for people to go to engines that aren't internal combustion engines, which are, you know, the electric cars or maybe something new is going to come out, solar cars or bad, you know, we've got the electric cars starting out now, but government has to make it more affordable for people to make that transition, which means maintaining subsidies or even increasing them on the purchases of electric vehicles. But, New Brunswick is a great opportunity to create green jobs by, why can't we make solar panels in New Brunswick? Why do they got to come from out of province or even offshore? Why do the wind turbines have to come into by boat at the Port of St. John? Why can't we build them here? Why can't we be a champion in wind power?
In Canada, I think a lot of people will think of the Alberta oil sands when it comes to industrial sources of greenhouse gases. But major emitters in New Brunswick include facilities, notably like the Irving Oil Refinery in St. John and NB Power's coal-fired power plant in Beldun. And the federal government has said the Beldun plant won't be able to burn coal past 2030.
There's a drop-dead date, yeah.
What's in store for workers in facilities like these?
Well, the opportunities are there, but like I said, it takes political will and it takes public investment.
Last week, the federal ministers of natural resources and labor, Jonathan Wilkinson and Seamus O'Regan Jr., announced the launch of the next round of consultations on a proposed legislation in support of a just transition. What role do you think organized labor should play in this kind of consultation process?
Labor is a significant stakeholder in any, not just transition or green economy discussions, but all discussions. I mean, you know, labor seems, organized labor specifically, and labor in general doesn't seem to be considered a stakeholder. They consult a whole lot more with business than they do with workers or those that represent workers.
New Brunswick Green Party leader David Kuhn feels governments aren't acting urgently enough on the transition away from fossil fuels. He also called for a just transition not only for workers in the energy sector, but also in the economy more generally, notably for workers whose jobs are eliminated because of automation.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, British Columbia. You are listening to Viewpoints.
The Gorge Harbor Marina Resort, located in Whaletown on Cortes Island, that's off the BC coast, is an important hub for the island's residents. It provides many amenities residents are counting on, like a grocery store and a laundromat. It is also an important place for liveaboards, people who live on their boats. And as such, it also provides some housing relief for Cortes Islanders, even if the marina has no pump-out service. The marina hosts many people living on boats every winter. Marina manager Bill Duggan says the Gorge Harbor Marina had 14 boats with liveaboards at the dock this winter. Duggan says there have been more people looking to live aboard their boats than he has space for. Our journalist Kate Madigan spoke with Bill Duggan, marina manager.
So this year we've got 14 boats on the dock with people living on them. Most of those cases are one to two people maximum. I have no families down there this year, though I have had families in the past, but just not this year. Is that an increase from last year? It's probably pretty similar to last year's numbers, though the demand has been greater than the space that I have available for sure.
So you've had 14 yep. boats right now.
Well, 14 that have liveaboards on them. I think there's a total of about 26 boats on the dock.
Oh, okay.
But I only have so much space, you know, that is safe space.
Safe space.
Yeah, safe space, meaning you're not going to get beat up by the waves. Like I can't put the liveaboards in a tie-up spot where they're going to be exposed to a lot of wind and waves. So I put them on the inside fingers. So I don't usually use the outside fingers very often at all, unless I get larger vessels.
So 14 liveaboards is about as many as you can handle, but there's been demand for more than that. Like you have to turn people away.
Yeah, definitely. I think this year I turned away 4 liveaboards, and I've already got 3 new liveaboards who have put their names into the pot for next year if a spot opens up. But every year we get new people. Some people move along. Some people, you know, move to a different area, and new ones come up. There's not a lot of places that will allow liveaboards further south of us for sure. So every year we always get new ones in. So So,
but I guess you're also dealing with in the gorge, there's all sorts of people that are anchored.
That is right. It's completely legal to come into the harbor here, even if you don't live here, drop a mooring and put your boat on it and not have to worry about it.
Indefinitely. Yeah.
Correct.
It's working out for you guys. Like, it's okay to have the liveaboards, and obviously you're happy to put a dent in the demand for housing on the island.
Yeah, it definitely helps. It's just another facet, I guess, of like the business. It allows people a comfortable place to live. The docks are safe. They always have 24/7 power with the generator on the property for backup. They've got the store right here. They've got, you know, green space to walk around in. They got a restaurant to go out and eat, and they have the showers and like the laundromat. So they are pretty set up pretty nicely to be on the docks here or just anchored out. It works out pretty good for them, and it works out pretty good to us. We do have issues, but it's no different than, you know, any other business having issues. There's always things that going on, but what we do find is most people are greatly appreciative to have a place just to tie up their boat and have a place to live. So generally issues are minimal.
Yeah, for sure. And it's pretty affordable too. What do you charge?
It's $6 a foot. So say a 40-foot boat, you're looking at $240 a month for the boat and then your power. And then there is a liveaboard fee. And the liveaboard fee is just for people that are, of course, living on their boats. But that gives them access to the bathrooms 24/7 and to the hot tub, gives them a parking spot and a place to throw out their garbage and all of that. So
the $240 or the $6 a foot doesn't include the like liveaboard fee.
Yeah, that's about $100. And then your power is about $50. So for a 40-foot boat, for instance, you would be looking at around $400 and $420 a month.
That's great.
Most liveaboard vessels are about 30 to 35 feet that we have on our dock. So
that's good. And do you have a pump-out place for people?
We don't have a pump-out. It's probably the bigger issue. There's no way, you know, for me to know if people are emptying directly into the harbor. There is a few people who I know that use the heads on their boat and they do go out and empty their tanks. But to be honest with you, we don't know what everyone else does. And it is an issue that we have been touching on more and more over the last couple of years as we do have more and more people living on the docks is the sewage issue. So we don't know what people are putting into it, but we want to make sure that they're not. We haven't really figured out a way to do that yet.
Right, because the Gorge Harbor is a no discharge zone, isn't it?
It's a no discharge zone, and it is, from what I've been told, the largest seafood producing harbor on the west coast of Canada. And so, you know, you've got $70,000 to $80,000 a week in seafood going out of this harbor, plus all the jobs that come along with that. They do test regularly around the Bee Islets. And I think over the years, I've only ever heard of one or maybe two tests that tested positive for fecal coliform. And that's over about 10 years. So
I guess the other thing is just insurance. There seems to be some insurance new rules around that coming down the pipe. Is that true? I understand that people are going to have their vessels regularly surveyed for insurance purposes. And how does that play out? Do you know much about that?
I haven't heard of any rules that are mandatory, any rules like that, whether like there's some marinas, for instance, that won't even let you on their docks unless you can prove that you have insurance on your boat. But they are the minority. But every insurance company wants you to be asking every boater who comes onto the dock that like question. But there are no rules. So,
but you're not going to do that.
I personally try to stay away from all of those rules unless they're mandatory. So yeah, I wouldn't do that.
Oh, well, that's good. Yeah. That's good for the liveaboards.
So insurance on my boat, for instance, cost me $1,600 a year. To get it surveyed cost me $1,000. You know, so basically insurance companies or, you know, private marinas are probably trying to say, well, we'll allow liveaboards if they're liveaboards that we like or we want on our dock. So rules like that are just there to keep away the people that they don't want on their docks. That's what rules like that are for.
Kate Madigan, CKTZ News, Cortez Island.
The Shawville Lions Country Jamboree will return this summer after a two-year hiatus due to the pandemic. Shawville is a small town located in Quebec, some 80 kilometers west of Ottawa, Ontario. The Shawville Jamboree will bring hundreds of music fans to town as the organizers of the annual festival are planning for a big event in July of 2022. Clarendon Mayor and organizer Ed Walsh said that the Jamboree, which typically attracts more than 1,000 people to the Armstrong Farm just outside of town, is one of the biggest fundraisers in the calendar for the Lions. Some 20 entertainers should take the stage if all goes according to plan. More with Caleb Nickerson, who spoke with Mayor and organizer Ed Walsh.
Hopefully it'll be a success, so we'll see what happens.
And you guys were shut down for 2 years there with COVID?
Yeah, well, it'll be 3 years there now because our last one was in 2019, so we lost 2020 and 2021, so by the time it kicks off this time, it'll be actually 3 full years. So.
And this is one of the biggest events that the Lions put on, is it not?
Yes. It's probably one of our biggest. Between the fair and this, it's probably became the biggest fundraiser that we've had. But when this got shut down, we did the online auction there the last couple of years to try and create some revenue or whatever. So it's been a fairly successful adventure too or whatever. So it's almost as good as the Jamboree or whatever. So.
And so how many people do you typically have out to these?
Over the course of the weekend there, I'd have to pull out all the papers. Like it's been 3 years, but we usually get, we're over 1,000 people for sure, so, yeah.
Jeez, and they're coming from all over there? Or?
Yeah, they pretty well come there. We have a lot of people from northern Ontario and the Valley and, all over the Pontiac and Ontario, other places in Ontario. And plus, we even had the last two festivals in a row we had actually a person that came all the way up from Florida just for it, so.
Jeez.
Yeah, so it was, it's been fairly popular, and I mean, since the word started going out, like I said, we're going to get our website up, well, we have our website running, but we haven't put all the lineup in yet, because we just got to finalize a couple of entertainers and stuff like that there, so it's been fairly popular and successful, and it's drawing the people in, but people are already getting the word out there that it's coming back, and I've already got some responses saying, oh my God, we can't wait, and stuff like that there. So hopefully we do get a good turnout. So
that's good.
People are just tired of being stuck at home and stuff like that, So.
Oh yeah, it's understandable for sure.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about the type of music that you guys have there and sort of the performers? Do you mainly pick from sort of the Ottawa Valley area? Or?
We try to keep some local, and then from there on, this year, our goal is, as every year, we usually have 20 entertainers. So the majority of them are, we'll have, five or six from within the local area, because you want to promote the local entertainers as well. But then one or two entertainers from Montreal, and we have one coming all the way from London, Ontario, and stuff like that there. So there are people coming from a great distance to come to it or whatever, but a lot of them are out of the valley and stuff like that, Armprior and those places over there as well, or whatever, Kingston in that area. So,
and so just to close out here, Ed, could you tell our listeners here where and when this is going on, and how they can get tickets or book their RV camping spots there?
Yeah, the actual dates for the Jamboree are the starting Thursday, July 14th to Sunday, July 17th, and Thursday night is the open mic night, so that's even promotes more of the local people for doing it, and then on Friday we start with our live entertainment, and Saturday's a full day of entertainment as well. And then for tickets, we have an actual website. It's just called the Shawville Lions Country Jamboree, and if you go on there, there's a link there. Like I said, we still have to get that updated, so we hope to have that done within the next week or so, and it'll have the links there to how to purchase your tickets and, you know, and get a registration if you're bringing a trailer, and then the cost and all that for like just a day pass or a weekend pass if you're coming in as a walk-in and that there. So that'll all be up and running there hopefully within the next week. Well, like I said, it's up and running. We just got to get all the information on it up to date. So.
Awesome. Ed, I want to thank you for your time there, unless you have anything else to add or anything that we missed here.
No, just if you guys feel like promoting it and getting the word spread out, we'd greatly appreciate it. Like I said, after a three-year hiatus, it's a lot of people have they're looking forward to get out, but it's just there might be still a little bit of leeriness or whatever by then, but by July, you know, a lot of the restrictions should be removed completely and stuff like that. So I think if we can get the word out and people not... They say if you build it, they will come. So hopefully they do. They come in full force. So.
Awesome. Well, I wish you luck.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're on the air with Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
The century-old Astor Theatre is slowly coming back to life as COVID-19 restrictions are lifted. So when we dig into the theatre's website, we learn, and I quote, that the Astor Theatre, built in 1902, was originally known as the Liverpool Opera House. Its stage hosted touring and local shows until 1917. Imagine that's when silent films were introduced. During World War II, the cinema featured regular war documentaries. Shortly after the war, the theater was renovated to accommodate more people. For a time, there were few live presentations, but in 1979, with increased interest in live presentations, the Astor began presenting local talent through The Winds of Change, a dramatic society. The stage was increased in size. The Astor Theater Society was then incorporated in 1987 as a non-profit charitable organization. The Astor has played host to many touring artists, including Jill Barber, Rufus Wainwright, Rita McNeil, Mr. Dress-Up, Symphony Nova Scotia, Debut Atlantic, and the Royal Shakespeare Company, to name just a few. People come to the Astor Theatre also to admire its tin ceiling. Our journalist Ed Halverson has more.
As COVID restrictions relax, life is beginning to return to normal at Liverpool's Astor Theatre. General Manager Jean Robinson-Dexter says the arts venue was hit hard throughout the pandemic.
Our revenues over the last fiscal year and part of the year before, way down, negligible. In fact, because we haven't either had rentals for concerts or shows.
She says financial support from all levels of government kept the theater afloat during the pandemic. Some changes are coming as the venue ramps up their offerings. Robinson-Dexter says the Astor is adjusting their box office schedule to open from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Wednesday through Saturday to include the weekend.
By making that bit of a shift, folks that aren't able to join us during a weekday can come downtown and, you know, do a little shopping, have a coffee, and come to the galleries.
In addition to art and live music, the Astor is once again showing movies. Robinson-Dexter understands some patrons may feel uneasy about mask requirements being lifted, but says people are still welcome to wear their masks in the Astor.
They are not obliged, but if folks are more comfortable doing that, we're very happy for them to do that.
Hello, I'm Ed Halverson in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, and you're listening to Viewpoints.
We go now to Ontario, where the Ottawa Police Service Hate and Bias Crime Unit's annual report highlights a sharp increase in hate-related crimes during 2021. Hate-motivated crimes have increased by nearly 44% in 2021, according to the service, which included mischief to property, assault, assault with a weapon, and other crimes. The OPS data indicates a consistent rise in hate-motivated crimes over the last 3 years, 340 40 who reported incidents in 2021, up from 181 in 2020 and 116 in 2019. This is a troubling trend considering not all hate-motivated incidents are reported to police, says OPS Sergeant Ali Togrol. More with our Ottawa journalist, Mara Bélanger.
According to the Ottawa Neighbourhood Study, 241,000 individuals, or one quarter of Ottawa's population, are racialized people. The OPS report indicates the most commonly targeted demographics were residents identifying as Jewish, Black, LGBTQ+, East and Southeast Asian, Arab and West Asian, and Muslim. The data from the report only contains information on hate crimes committed in 2021. However, there is some evidence indicating the rate of hate-motivated crimes will increase further over 2022. In response to a high volume of hate crime reports during the nearly month-long occupation of Ottawa, the OPS created a hate-motivated crime hotline which received hundreds of calls. According to the OPS, every hate-related report is investigated, but of the 340 reports of hate-motivated crimes in 2021, 240 were criminal and only 26 individuals were charged. A proposed amendment to the criminal code could result in a broader definition of hate crimes and stricter charges for those who commit them. Minister of Justice and Attorney General David Lametti announced Bill C-36 in June 2021. Lametti says that in addition to tougher consequences for people who commit hate crimes, the new legislation will help protect the vulnerable and empower those who are victimized. In its current form, the amendment would add a definition for hatred to the existing criminal code, as well as measures to address online hate speech and prevent hate propaganda. The bill didn't pass through the House of Commons, but is currently being reworked by the federal Liberals, who promised to reintroduce the legislation as soon as possible. I'm Mara Bélanger.
And so this ends this edition of Viewpoints, produced by the Local Journalism Initiative and presented by the Community Radio Fund of Canada in collaboration with campus and community radios across the country. You can listen to all of our programs on canada-info.ca. Also, tune in to all the stories produced by our journalists working across the country in British Columbia, Ontario, Quebec, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and elsewhere on canada-info.ca. Their radio pieces are posted there on a daily basis. They allow us to discover Canada and our local communities from different perspectives. Thanks to our journalists Caleb Nickerson, Ed Halverson, David Gordon Koch, Mara Bélanger, and Kate Madigan, and also to their guest, and to Maureen McEwen, our national coordinator. I'm Boris Chassaigne. Stay tuned to your local radio station. Thanks for being with us. Goodbye.
Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.